The Principles of the Most Ancient and Modern Philosophy by Anne Finch, Viscountess Conway. First published in 1690. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Chapter 8. Three More Arguments. My fourth argument to prove that spirit and body differ, not in essence, but only in degree, is based on the intimate union or bond that exists between spirits and bodies, by means of which spirits control the bodies they are united with, moving them around and using them as instruments in their various operations. If spirit and body are so opposite, with opposite attributes, if spirit is alive, a living and perceiving substance, whereas body is merely a dead mass, and if spirit is penetrable and indivisible, whereas body is impenetrable and divisible, then tell me, what is it that unites and joins them so much? What are the chains or ties that hold them together so firmly and for so long? Also, when a spirit or soul gets separated from its body, and no longer controls it or has power to move it as before, what causes this separation? The philosophers I am opposing might reply, the previous union of the soul with the body was caused by the vital fit between them, and when the body decomposes, it stops vitally fitting the soul. Then I ask them, what is this vital fit? If they can't tell us what it consists in, they are babbling, producing empty words, ones with sound but no sense, and they surely can't answer my question satisfactorily. In their understanding of what body and spirit are, they don't fit one another in any way at all, because in their view, body is always dead matter, lacking life and perception, just as much when the spirit is in it as after it leaves. And if there were some fit between them, then it would of course remain the same whether the body was healthy or decomposed. My opponents may say, spirit requires an organized body to perform the vital actions of the external senses, and to move the body from place to place, and organization is lacking in a decomposed body. But this doesn't solve their difficulty. Why does spirit require such an organized body? Why, for example, can the spirit see only by means of such a wonderfully formed and organized corporeal eye as we have? Why does spirit need corporeal light rays if it's to see corporeal objects? And why can't the soul see an object unless an image of it is transmitted to the eye? If it is totally spirit and in no way body, why does it need such a variety of corporeal organs that are so greatly and deeply unlike it? And another thing, when one body, X, moves another body, Y, this involves Y's being impenetrable and therefore resisting X. So how can a spirit move its body or any of its limbs if it is, as they say it is, of such a nature that no part of the body can resist it in any way? If a spirit so easily penetrates each body, why is it that when it moves from place to place, it doesn't leave the body behind, since it can so easily pass through the body without the least resistance? Think about what happens with the sails of a ship. By means of them, the wind drives the ship along, and the driving force is lessened in proportion as there are more openings, holes, and passages in the sails. And if the sails were replaced by a giant net, the ship would barely move, even in a gale. This shows us the essential role of impenetrability in motion. If body and spirit were not mutually impenetrable, a spirit couldn't cause any body to move. Here is an objection that might be made to what I have been saying. God moves whatever bodies he pleases, and is indeed the original cause of all movement. Yet he is completely incorporeal, and is intimately present in all bodies, with nothing impenetrable about him. I answer that the motion by which God moves a body is completely different from the way a soul moves the body. The will of God that brought bodies into existence also made them move. So all motion comes from God, through his will. a creature can't move itself any more than it can bring itself into existence. It is in God that we live and move and have our being, as St. Paul said. So motion and being, or existence, come from the same cause, God the Creator. He lavishes motion on creatures without moving himself. He doesn't go from place to place because he's equally present everywhere. But the story of how the soul moves the body is nothing like that. The soul isn't the author of motion as such. It merely determines that this or that particular thing moves. The soul moves from place to place with the body, and if the body is imprisoned or chained down, the soul can't escape from the prison or the chains. It is very inappropriate to liken the motion of the body produced by the soul to the motion that all creatures get from God. It is on a par with likening a human builder's activity of constructing a ship or a house to God's activity of creating the first substance or matter. It is obvious that the two are very different. God brought his creatures into existence, but a carpenter doesn't bring into existence the wood from which he builds a ship. You say that the motions of every creature come from God, so you must think that he is or could be the author or cause of sin. No one will bring this against me. The power to move comes from God, but sin comes not from him, but from the creature that has misused this power by directing it to something other than it should. Thus sin is what the Greeks call ataxia, meaning a disorderly direction of motion to somewhere other than where it ought to be. Consider the example of a ship. That it moves at all is due to the wind. That it moves to this place or that place is due to the helmsman. The helmsman isn't the cause of the wind, but the wind is blowing, and he uses it well or badly. When he steers the ship to its destination, he is praised, but when he wrecks it by running it onto rocks, he is blamed and thought to deserve punishment. Another point. Why does the spirit or soul suffer so much when the body is harmed? If the spirit has nothing corporeal about it, even when united to the body, why is it so upset when the body, whose nature is allegedly so different, is damaged? If it's so easy for the soul to penetrate the body, how can any corporeal thing hurt it? The soul doesn't feel the pain. Only the body feels it. That can't be said by the people against whom I am arguing in this chapter, i.e., the ones who affirm that the body has no life or perception. On the other hand, all the difficulties that I have presented vanish if one accepts, as I do, that the soul is of one nature and substance with the body, although it is much more alive and spiritual than the body, more swift and penetrable and so on through various other perfections. Given this account of the situation, it is easy to grasp how the soul is united with body, moves the body, suffers with the body and through the body. There is a Kabbalah text showing that this was the opinion of the ancient Hebrews. We can easily grasp how one body is united with another through the true fit between their natures. The most finely divided and spiritual body can be united with a very thick and lumpy body by means of certain bodies that are intermediate between the two extremes. Intermediate, that is, on the spectrum from very fine-grained to very lumpy. These intervening bodies are the ties or links through which such a finely divided and spiritual soul is connected to such a lumpy body. When these intermediate spirits are absent or stop working, the union is broken. On this basis, we can easily grasp how a soul moves a body, just as one finely divided body can move another thick and lumpy one. And since a body is itself a sentient living thing, i.e., a perceiving substance, it is just as easy to grasp how one body can wound or bring pain or pleasure to another body, because things whose natures are the same or similar can easily affect each other. And this line of thought can be used to answer similar questions. How do spirits move other spirits? How do spirits contend or struggle with other spirits? How do good spirits promote unity, harmony, and friendship with each other? These things certainly do happen. the select few who know their own hearts learn from experience that there is such an expulsion and struggle of spirits, especially of good spirits, against evil ones. And the question of how this can happen seems to be unanswerable, if all spirits can be intimately present within each other. For how in that case can they contend with one another, struggle to occupy a position, expel another? Someone might say this: the spirits of God and Christ are intimately present in everything, yet they wage war against the devil and his spirits in the human heart. I answer that it isn't valid to compare God's operations with those of his creatures, because God's ways are infinitely superior to ours. Still, one valid difficulty still remains, arising from the following truth. When the spirits of God and Christ struggle against the devil and the evil spirits in the human heart, they unite with certain good spirits which they sanctify and prepare for this union, and use as a vehicle, a war chariot, in their battle with wicked spirits. In struggling against the good spirits in the human heart, the evil spirits are struggling against God and Christ. The good spirits are those of the pious and faithful person who used to be wicked and has since been made good. God and Christ help every pious person in the struggle to prevail over evil spirits, but God allows evil spirits to conquer those that are evil and unfaithful. He helps only those who fear and love him, and who obey him and believe in his power, goodness, and truth. When he unites with these people, their good spirits are like so many arrows and swords that wound and drive back the dark and impure spirits. The difficulty arising from this is as follows: how can a human soul, even one in the highest state of purity, be united with God, given that God is pure spirit, whereas the soul, though pure in the highest degree, is always somewhat corporeal? I answer that this happens through Jesus Christ, who is the true and appropriate medium between the two. Christ can be united with the soul immediately, without any help from a mediating link, because of their great affinity and likeness. The learned man, who hold that the natures of body and spirit are completely opposite, can't say that. I take my fifth argument from what we observe in all visible bodies, such as earth, water, stones, wood, etc. What an abundance of spirits there are in all these things! For earth and water continually produce animals, as they did in the beginning. A pool full of water produces fish, without any fish having been put there to breed. Since everything else comes from earth and water originally, it necessarily follows that the spirits of all animals are in the water. That is why Genesis says that the Spirit of God hovered over the face of the waters, so that from the waters he would bring forth whatever was created afterwards. A possible objection goes like this: your argument doesn't prove that all spirits are bodies, only that all bodies contain the spirits of all animals. Now, granted that each body has a spirit in it, and that the spirit and the body are united, their natures are still different, so that they can't be changed into each other. I reply that if each body, even the smallest, has in itself the spirits of all animals and other things, just as matter is said to have all forms within itself, does it have all these spirits in it actually, or only potentially? If actually, the question arises, how can so many spirits actually exist in their different essences in a small body, even in the smallest conceivable? It couldn't happen, unless the spirits were intimately present to the parts of the body, so that they didn't take up any space. But a capacity for intimate presence is something that no creature can have, as I have already shown. Also, if spirits of all kinds exist in each body, even the smallest, how does it happen that this kind of animal is produced from this kind of body, and not from that? Why doesn't a single body give rise immediately to all kinds of animals? We know from experience that this doesn't happen, and that nature does everything systematically, with one kind of animal being formed from another, and one species coming from another, whether rising to a higher perfection or sinking to a lower one. If, on the other hand, the answer is that all kinds of spirits, with their different essences, are contained in each body, not actually but only potentially, then the objection to my position collapses, because that answer implies that the body and all those spirits are the same, i.e., that body can be changed into those spirits. Compare, wood is potentially fire, i.e., can be changed into fire, and water is potentially air, i.e., can be changed into air, and so on. And the thesis that bodies can be changed into spirits is precisely what I am here defending. When the present objector concedes that bodies always have or contain spirits, I use this concession as the basis for another argument against him. If spirits and bodies are so inseparably united to each other that no body can be without spirit, indeed without many spirits, this in itself is surely a weighty argument that they are of one basic nature and substance. Otherwise, it would be incomprehensible to us that they wouldn't eventually separate from each other in various strange dissolutions and separations. Last point. How does it happen that when a body decomposes, other species are generated from this mess? Animals come forth from decomposing water or earth. Even rocks, when they rot, turn into animals, and mud or other decomposing matter generates animals, all of which have spirits. How does the rotting or decomposing of a body lead to animals, being newly generated? You might try this answer. What happens is that this decomposition, this process of rotting, releases the spirits of these animals from their chains, so to speak, freeing them to form and shape new bodies for themselves from the rotted matter by means of their plastic natures. I reply, how did the body in its prime, before it started to rot, so strongly hold those spirits captive? By being hard and dense? If so, then those imprisoned spirits are nothing but finely divided bodies. Otherwise the hardness and denseness of the body couldn't lock them in. If a spirit were capable of being intimately present within a body, so that it could penetrate the hardest body as easily as the softest, it could as easily go from one body to another, with no need for decomposition or death to generate new life. So the fact, if it is a fact, that spirits are held captive in certain hard bodies and are liberated when the bodies become soft, is clear evidence that spirit and body have the same basic nature, that body is nothing but fixed and condensed spirit, and spirit nothing but finely divided or volatile body. This is the place to mention the following facts. In all hard bodies, ordinary pebbles and precious stones, metals, herbs, trees, animals, and all human bodies, there are many spirits imprisoned, so to speak, in dense bodies and united with them, unable to come out and fly away into other bodies until death or dissolution occurs. There are also many other very finely divided spirits that do continually come out of these hard bodies. It's because they are so finely divided that they can't be held in by the hardness of the bodies they inhabit. And these finely divided spirits are productions of the lumpier spirits detained in the body. The latter spirits, though trapped in the body, are not idle in their prison. The body is a kind of workshop for them, where they make the more finely divided spirits that are then given off in colours, sounds, odours, tastes, and various other properties and powers. So the hard body and the spirits it contains are like the mother of the more finely divided spirits, their children. That is nature's way. It always works towards more complete fine-grainedness and spirituality, because that is the most natural property of every operation and motion. All motion grinds a thing down and divides it, thereby making it subtle and spiritual. In the human body, for example, food and drink are first changed into chyle, and then into blood, and after that into spirits, which are nothing but perfectly fine-spun blood. And these spirits, whether good or bad, always move on to an even greater degree of subtlety or spirituality. Through the spirits that come from blood, we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, and feel. Through them, indeed, we also think, love, hate, and do everything we do. They are the source of the seed through which the race propagates, and especially of the human voice and speech, which is full of those good or bad spirits formed in the heart. As Christ taught, the mouth speaks out of the abundance of the heart. A good man out of the good treasure of the heart brings forth good things. And Christ also said, nothing that enters a man from without can defile him. What can defile a man are the things that come out of him. And these are men's angels, or ministering spirits, the ones Christ is speaking of when he says of the little ones who believe in him, their angels look upon the face of my heavenly Father. There are also other angels, good and bad, that come to men. But the ones I am talking about here are the angels that belong specifically to human beings, the angels of believers who become like little children. I draw the sixth and final argument from certain texts of both the Old and New Testaments, which show in clear and explicit words that everything has life and is truly alive in some degree. He gives to everything life and breath, etc. God makes everything live. He is not called the God of the dead, but of the living. This last is being said primarily about human beings, but it is a more general truth, holding for everything else as well. He is indeed the God of all the things, human beings included, that are resurrected and regenerated in their own kind. I speak of resurrection, because the death of those things isn't their annihilation, but a change from one kind or degree of life to another. And thus, the apostle declares the resurrection of the dead, and illustrates it with the example of a grain of wheat that falls to the ground, dies, and rises again as something fruitful. End of chapter 8. End of the work.